Welcome to the Bible Live Quiz Hour. It's time to test and grow your knowledge of the Bible.
The entire Bible every year.
On Sunday nights at 9, join us here for the Bible Live Quiz Hour. Soapy will ask questions from the Bible Live leaders. You call in with the correct answers and you win. It's just that simple. So get out your Bible, put on your thinking cap, and hit that speed dial. Because here's the host of the Bible Live. Your Apache Indian scout through the Book of Books, Soapy Dollar.
All right. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us tonight. Stacy is here with me, and we're ready to get started on another adventure in the scriptures. So moving on to the books of Samuel, 1 and 2 Samuel, right?
Yes, which I always think is, it's interesting. We just came from Luke, which is a nice reprieve after the book of Judges. And it's just nice to see, where we're going and have that sweet reminder of Jesus as our goal. that he's who we can keep our eyes on, who we can focus on in the midst of a lot of just uncertainty and turmoil, which Judges was. So Luke was a nice break, and we come back now to Samuel. I think that this time period is especially interesting because you see kind of God's hand at work in the process of nation building. So not only, of course, the whole scripture is about Jesus. We're working towards that moment, that the Messiah, the plan that he has to bring us back into fellowship with him, to redeem us, right? He's calling out a people for himself. But out of that people group, there has to be a people group, a stability. It's almost kind of, it's kind of like on a smaller scale, the family unit is so important for children to flourish, and to, it's almost as if, he needs a group of people out of which to bring this Messiah. And that is what this nation building is happening. That's what this nation group is, Israel. He needs a stable group of people, as can be, as crazy humans. But, and so it's interesting to see how he's working. We try it all the time. Look at this world, these kingdoms here on this own. Kingdoms rise and they fall, and they rise and they fall. And we've studied, it's been a great study. How can you have a kingdom that not fall? How can you create a sustainable, a stable polity of people? And I think our founding fathers actually did an incredible job in checks and balances, make sure that it's not, that power is spread out, that you've not centralized. And a lot of what they took from was scripture, Deuteronomy, those laws. Moses and those very foundational kind of laws that will help a people group be sustained. And so you see in Judges, they are still very, the tribe, they're very tribal still. There's not much of a central ideal. God was supposed to be their king, if you will. He was supposed to be who they're looking to, but everybody did what was right in their own eyes, and it was very tribal and kind of divided. It was still, Dad and I, we talked a little bit about this before. Why was it wrong for them to ask for a king? And it wasn't. They could have a king in Deuteronomy. It points to, yes, you can, but it had to be a certain type of king. And when you see in Samuel, by the time they get to Samuel, and this is very typical of the people of Israel. They kind of go through something painful and a punishment, and then they, draw back to God, or, you know, but they need that. It's like the pain and the punishment is what makes them draw back to God, as opposed to really a heart transformation. And so the Philistines, though, the Israelites tout the ark, and they think that just because they have the ark, they're going to win. They get the idea that they're just sort of using God as their little, you know, rabbit's foot, their little
good luck charm,
right? And God does not have any of that, and he allows the Philistines to defeat them. The Philistines actually take the ark, and so that was a moment, though, of kind of repentance from the Israelites and recognizing that they are abusing their relationship with God. The Philistines, though, they have all sorts of plagues hit them and disease, and they don't want the ark, so they can get it back. And but it was out of that that the Israelites start to demand a king, and you hear they're in their demands, we want a king like all of the other nations. And that's the key, and I think where they went wrong was it wasn't so much that a king was sinful, it was that they were looking for all of the wrong things in their king. They wanted a king to quote-unquote fight for them. They wanted a king probably very similar to the kind of Messiah that many of the Jews were looking for in the time of the Romans. They wanted somebody to just come in and kind of do their bidding and fight the fights that they wanted fought.
I noticed the way that desire for a king expressed is that we want a king like other nations.
Right.
I've always been intrigued. They wanted to get to be like other nations, but I think you're right. The principal reason, I guess, was wanting to be, they thought it might be a better organized way to run the country. And it is granted to them. Now, remember, they're coming out of the time of Judges, and they are internally divided. They're tribe against tribe. They've almost eliminated the tribe of Benjamin,
right,
because of warfare. And there was a lot of dissension between the tribes. So they were internally divided and beset externally by other nations, attacked from generally all around. And we have to remember that Israel, that little piece of real estate that God promised to Abraham and so on, that little piece of country that was formed was in the middle, exactly in the middle of the rising and falling empires that you spoke of, starting with Egypt, Moab, and from the south, and then you go up to Damascus and the Arameans, and then you get into Nineveh and the Assyrians, and then Babylon and the Babylonians. It's in the center of these rising and falling kingdoms. So it's strategically placed, and that they are a unique group of people. They are monotheist, beginning, of course, with Abraham. He is from the Chaldeans, and he was a monotheist. He worshipped one true God, the creator God, the only God. And that's a unique position, and they have a hard time holding on to that. They're constantly tempted away from it, to being polytheists and idolaters and so on. And the other thing I think it's important, Stacy, to mention about about Israel mm-hmm. and your idea there of a people group that God would use to keep alive his name in the worship of the true living God and through whom he could bring the Messiah, the Redeemer, it is that that was never a political entity. I just I like to emphasize it because we yes. tend to think of Israel as a nation like they all that share a same race or so. Right. Now, that just isn't true. Israel was made up principally of Aramean background, let's say the children of Israel. But we have to constantly remind ourselves that Israel was not biologically or genetically called. There are people called, the distinctive about right. Israel mm-hmm. was they worship the one true right. living God. There were many right. members yeah. that were not...
Ethnically, they were not ethnically. Right.
Descended from Abraham. Mm-hmm. Take Rahab that we just right. talked about.
Or even from the very beginning, the Egyptians that left with... Yes. There were Egyptians that saw everything that happened, were witness to it, and they were like, we're with them. We're yeah. with that. We're with God. And, you know, they crossed over the dry land and the Red Sea just as well as the Israelites did. They were Israel at that
point.
And
that's very important for us to remember that Israel, when the Bible talks about Israel, mm-hmm. the truest, deepest meaning of Israel, of the word Israel even, it's the people of God, mm-hmm. those who worship the true and living God. Mm-hmm. For example, today we are Israel. Mm-hmm. We are the people called of God from all over the world, mm-hmm. every nation in the planet. There are people who love the Lord and through the Messiah. They mm-hmm. come to Christ. And it was the Messiah who brought about this explosion of yeah. worship of the one true God around the world. No one has ever brought more people into the worship of the true and living God, more people than Jesus Christ has more folks now following right. Jehovah, the Lord God of Israel, than because of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so we have to keep that in mind. Sometimes, of course, it is talking about the people group as they existed at that moment.
Right, as a
nation. Their political status and mm-hmm. so on. It's talking about them. But the truest meaning is always the people of God that yes. worship him and follow him.
Yeah, it is a hard, I think, a really great study of, you know, because God's never just, like you always say, he's never just doing something in the here and now. There's always a spiritual reality that is parallel to the, and that's, it is, so it's interesting. It's because we all long for, I mean, I think we can look even at the world and look at the politics and the political and, you know, there's this longing for like a heaven on earth. And even in, you know, may your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. You know, we right. long for that, but we also have to recognize that it's never going to be, as long as, you know, good and evil coexist and we live in a fallen, broken world until he comes again, yeah. until he comes in glory, that we always have to make accommodation, you know, and realize that sin is a reality here and move and operate with that and with the checks and balances. And I mean, that's why the Mosaic right. Law is so fascinating, because it deals with much of it is how do we deal with, how do people who are sinful operate and function together without killing each other, pretty much. I mean, without just completely destroying each other. And so...
Well, the answer is we barely do it.
We barely, isn't that right? Yeah, and that interesting. And that's why the fam. I mean, that's, you know, the best chance I think of that, and why I've always thought why you want to put. I mean, that's why, you know, when you have a court of law, you know, when you're judged, you are your court. You're judged by your peers, by the place that you, where you committed the crime, where you live, mm-hmm. is also, if there's going to be a jury, kind of the people, because they know you best. They know the context best. They know sort of, you want your, and if you're, like, if you're a child, you know, if you're a kid, you want your parents to be the ones that punish you, because they know that you'll do it lovingly, because there's a best chance of love and punishment going together when it's somebody that knows you.
That's a very interesting thought, actually, right there. Maybe you can expand on that. But all this makes, oh my goodness.
Hey, speaking of phone calls.
These are so good to have. We talk to people around the world whenever we want to, and right in the middle of a radio program.
I did want to, we read 1 Samuel this past week. We got into a little bit of 2 Samuel, and you can listen at thebiblelive.com or just biblelive.com. Has all of the readings, and we do have a place for questions. This will be the first week we want to, we have some questions. And if you would be interested in answering these, you can email Soapy, Soapy, Soap with a Y, at thebiblelive.com any answers to some questions that we might have.
So that's the way we'll do that now. All right. Okay. Well, I think we've kind of laid a general understanding about Israel, what God is doing mm-hmm. in the big picture. Now, this actually fits midway between Abraham and the coming of Jesus.
Okay, in the timeline. Okay.
In that timeline. And this is when they will move from being guided and led by the judges. Mm-hmm. And like we say, they came out divided, internally divided, at odds with each other, and under heavy attack by other people groups around them. And so they need a time of transition. Mm-hmm. Samuel takes them from the era of the emphasis on the priesthood, Eli. Now, the priesthood doesn't disappear until Messiah, mm-hmm. actually, and the Roman Empire. They destroyed Jerusalem, and the priesthood at that time is removed. But we're moving from the priesthood, so the emphasis increasingly now will be on the prophets.
Okay.
That God calls them individually. We learn the stories, and they courageously and bravely, and for the most part, at least courageously and bravely, represent mm-hmm. God and to the people and to the leadership mm-hmm. as well. So Samuel is that transitional character from the priesthood to the prophet, and from the judges to kings now, and we begin to see at least it's a process of, as you point out rightly, confusion and fallen man. We still see the man that's fallen, but at least we get to see him fallen in a new way.
Right.
Every now and again they have a godly king who loves the Lord and who gives them good leadership. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, that is not the picture that we'll mm-hmm. get. The book of Samuel opens up with the story of Samuel's birth, which is quite unusual mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm.
I identify with Samuel quite a bit myself. Not entirely, but he, you know, he had a mom and dad. He knew who his mom and dad were. I personally don't know exactly. We have an idea who my mother may have been. She was an Apache girl off the reservation, Yolanda Sunshine. And what's her name? And if you think Soapy Dollars are weird, how about Soapy Sunshine?
Soapy Sunshine.
That would be a little bit of, I don't know, an improvement or not. But anyway, a mixed up family background. And then he goes and he's adopted to a degree, almost like adopted by Eli, the high priest of his era, and he has sons as well that are, I suppose, are somewhat like older brothers to Samuel. Mm-hmm. But Samuel is raised then by Eli, and he works around the temple, around the tabernacle, I'm sorry, not the temple, and he picks up, cleans up, does chores for Eli, and I suppose he learns a great deal about God and following God. But some of that may have come from his mother as well.
Yeah.
So maybe you can tell us about his birth, about Hannah.
Yeah, and I think one of the as you read Samuel, at least for me this time around, the what has been standing out is just this juxtaposition, I guess, of humility and pride. And
Juxtaposition. That is a hard word for me to pronounce.
Oh, I bet so. I'm sorry. Let's just say comparing.
Yeah.
There's a comparing different, you know, you hate to, you know, you don't, of course, ultimately what we're looking to is, remember, Jesus, of course, he is, and we have all have fallen, you know, all, none of us are humble enough, you know, none of us are, we all have fallen, we all need Jesus, his grace, his salvation, but when you compare just the hearts of, and you see, when you just see two different roads, you know, Eli's sons, here they were the sons of the high priest. I mean, they had it. I mean, they were as kind of high up in the social status as you could be. They were, and yet they squandered it. I mean, they didn't think anything of it. They were, they broke the laws. They were evidently did not have a great relationship with the very people they were supposed to be kind of leading, and they're the priest. And you see,
they abused their power.
They abused it, and you see what happens with them. They die. they're killed young, and it's sad. I mean, and then you see Hannah. Well, and then you see Samuel, and Samuel is the son of just this broken woman who was not able to have children. So she's barren. She's longing and praying and hoping for to be pregnant. And then she does, she gets pregnant. She gives all glory to God. She had told him, you know, told God, if you give me a son, I will give him to your service. I will commit him to you. And so she does, but you just have this heart that is completely dependent. You know, we talk about, in the Lachlan courses, talk about faith, and you have just even at the very beginning, what is the definition of faith? It's utterly reliant on, completely dependent on, and then specifically with Christianity, it's Jesus and his work on the cross to save you. And you get that sense. I mean, Hannah has faith.
Let me read. We're about to take our break.
Yes.
Let me read just a few verses from the Hannah's prayer of praise to the Lord. Mm-hmm. My heart rejoices in the Lord. Mm-hmm. The Lord had made me strong. Now I have an answer for my enemies. I rejoice because you rescued me. No one is holy like the Lord. There's no one besides you. There's no rock like our Lord. And this passage highlights what you said, Stacy. Stop acting so proud and haughty. Don't speak with such arrogance. For the Lord is a God who knows what you have done. He will judge your actions. And on and on. It's a beautiful prayer of Hannah, of giving thanks to the Lord. And then, of course, God had something very special in mind for Samuel. And the way he is called into ministry, we can talk about that maybe when we come back. His calling into ministry, it's kind of funny. God calls him.
Literally.
And he says, well, and he keeps thinking it's Eli calling him. Yeah, and Eli finally gets the idea and said, next time you hear it, say, your servant is listening. You speak, Lord. I hear you. I'm listening. Because he didn't know that God, would God knocking at the door of his heart and his life. It's really kind of funny about it.
Right. It is sweet. And but you see kind of that one, this sort of pride and in your face. And then, but behind the scenes, very humble, the beginnings of this new priest who is going to be prophet that will usher them in. And there's our music. And so we will go to our first break. We will come back and continue talking about Samuel.
Because I'm talking to you. Jesus is the only one can carry you through. Now you better get ready because I'm telling you why. Jesus is the coming from his throne on high. Many are the weary, the lone and sad. They're going to wish they hadn't done the things they had. Now how you going to feel about when the things he said on that judgment day? I say now.
Welcome back. This is the Bible Live.
Was that you singing there?
Oh, I wish. Yes. No, I can't take credit for that. I wish. Well, welcome back. Yeah, this is the Bible Live. I'm Stacy, and it's my dad, Soapy. And we are, this past week, we listened through 1 Samuel and got into even the beginning of 2 Samuel, and we were just recapping that a little bit, discussing it. Before we took this first break, we were talking about God's calling of Samuel, and it is kind of a humorous moment because he literally calls Samuel. He's asleep. Eli is the priest under which Samuel is kind of and under his tutelage. Hannah is Samuel's mother, who was just joyful and praised God. You get that beautiful poem that she writes in the beginning of Samuel, that we think that maybe even Mary probably knew that poem. And there are some similarities with Mary's song when she finds out she's pregnant and Hannah's. But so Samuel is Hannah's son. Hannah has given Samuel to the priesthood, and Samuel is coming up under Eli's teaching. Samuel's asleep. He hears a voice calling to him. Samuel wakes up and thinks it's Eli. He runs to Eli and says, you know, I'm here. What are you doing? And Eli's like, no, I didn't call you. Go back to bed.
Go back to bed. Yeah.
And so Samuel goes back to bed. And then again, the voice, and Samuel raises up, runs to Eli. Here I am. Did you call me? I didn't call you. Go back to bed. So Samuel does. I believe it's the third time.
Yes.
The Lord calls out again, Samuel. And again, Samuel gets up and goes to Eli. Here I am. Did you call me? I didn't call you.
But by then, Eli is starting even to understanding that maybe something else is going on here.
Then Eli realized it was the Lord who was calling the boy. So he said to Samuel, go and lay down again. And if someone calls again, say, speak, Lord, your servant is listening. So Samuel went back to bed, and the Lord came and called as before, Samuel, Samuel. And Samuel obeys and replies, "Speak, your servant is listening." And that is when the Lord speaks to Samuel and kind of reveals what his plans are. There will be judgment on Eli's sons. There'll be judgment on Eli and it's hard. I mean, it's probably very sad news. I mean, Samuel, I'm sure, sees at least Eli as a father figure. And so at the next day, I don't think Samuel really wanted to tell Eli, but Eli says, "Tell me everything."
And it even makes a point of him of saying he didn't hold anything back.
Right. Yeah.
Because, and as we said in chapter 2, there was a warning given to Eli about the behavior of his sons. And it's interesting that from here on, many of the problems that we see from Eli and even forward now to other people, even to Samuel, the problems that come upon them primarily are based in the family.
Oh,
isn't
yeah.
that interesting?
Well,
the children don't follow the family. The family may not. The dad doesn't give good leadership to them.
Discipline.
Yeah.
That's even
and,
one of
So we'll see that increasingly. They were warned in chapter 2. In chapter 3, God reveals that he is going to judge the house of Eli. Mm. And he does that through Samuel. This was the first warning the first message that Samuel had to deliver is a message of judgment.
Eli takes it pretty well.
Yeah.
It is the Lord's will, Eli replied. Let him do what he thinks is best. And so Samuel grew up. The Lord was with him, and everything Samuel said proved to be reliable, which is one of the marks of course, a prophet, that what they say needs to then, yes, indeed happen. And I think that and Samuel's words went out to all the people of Israel. So that kind of establishes Samuel's authority and his role and his position and relationship with the Lord. And then, of course, with the people.
And then it will continually grow through the years he becomes the de facto spiritual leader, at least, of the nation.
I'll go ahead and put a question out there because this kind of goes along with what you were saying just in regards to discipline. And I've always liked this. This is in 1 Samuel. It's chapter 15, verses 22 through 23. What is more important to God than religious ritual and ceremony?
Yes.
What is more important to God than religious ritual and ceremony? And you get the sense that this would be something that Eli really could have, he would have done well to have this lesson learned earlier. Because, you know, maybe with his sons, it says, you did not discipline them. So Eli gets, the sons get punished for blasphemy and for what they've done, which are kind of the obvious. But Eli gets punished as well because he didn't discipline his sons. And there's this, an interest, a concentration on the importance of an emphasis on the importance of obedience. So, and so Eli's sons were disobedient. Their hearts were disobedient. And then a lack of discipline. I always loved that, you know, God disciplines those that he loves. You get almost this sense that maybe Eli was so focused on the ritual, on the, you know, his sons maybe fitting or doing certain pot cutting, but not on them actually obeying and not their heart posture of humility and of servanthood. And he never cared enough to just to really discipline his sons. I don't know if there's much of a connection, but I thought it was a good question.
Well, the same thing is important for us to remember that, you know, we properly rejoice and celebrate the baptism of your son this past
yes,
week.
That's
and
good.
We have these rituals as well, mm-hmm. baptism and right. the Lord's Supper and so on. But to know that those are meaningful and are right and good to celebrate and to honor, but beyond the ritual, it's a reality of new life in Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Baptism celebrates a new birth. We're buried with Christ in mm-hmm. baptism, raised to walk in newness of life.
Right.
And so
we
have that same principle that yes. we have to observe ourselves today.
I always love what our pastor says. It's a physical representation of a spiritual reality. And so if that spiritual reality isn't there, the physical representation is meaningless. So more important, though, to God than religious ritual and ceremony is what? That is in 1 Samuel chapter 15. And if you know the answer, email.
Yeah, you kind of gave the answer.
I kind of did. But
if you want to answer any of these questions, you can email me, soapy@thebiblelive.com. And I would be glad to note it, and maybe we'll
speak on it next week.
A little of interchange between us
yes.
on the internet.
All right, well, let's keep going. So Samuel, what's next? So the ark is taken
yes.
by the Philistines, and so then you get into the people demanding of Samuel a king like all of the other nations have.
It's funny because we lead from that warning about ritual.
Right.
Now we have the ark.
Yes.
Now the ark is a serious thing. It's a very it's ordained by God himself.
Mm-hmm.
It's real. The presence of God it represents in their midst. And so they tried to use it as a good luck charm.
Right.
And they're in the battle with the Philistines. And Philistines are people, warlike people. They come from across the Mediterranean. And they're seafaring, very powerful, very warlike.
Mm-hmm.
And they are become now an enemy of Israel, kind of historical enemy. And they steal the ark because they're using it as a good luck charm. They say, we're going to war. Let's bring the ark out and put it out in front, and we'll win for sure. And, of course, it doesn't happen. And the Philistines actually kidnap mm-hmm. or they gain possession of the ark. But sometimes you got to be careful what you ask for, right?
Yes, and so it's God allows right the Israel to be defeated, and the ark is taken by the Philistines, and I think they don't know what they right, like you said they don't know what they have, and because they have it though, and there is a disregard for they don't have any respect for they don't understand it they don't know anything, God there's plagues and diseases come upon them, and the Philistines say, no, we don't want this. Never mind. Here, take it back. And so it gets returned. But in that, and all of that has happened, there is a humility. It's sort of similar to the time of the judges. It reminds me of something that is in one of the Psalms that talks about, I don't want to be a person that is ruled by bit and bridle. You know, you don't want to be someone that has to have punishment constantly be what turns you to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And so, but that is what Israel, in this time period, it seems like they are so immature. They're very childlike still in terms of their faith and their relationship with God. And he's constantly, it's punishment or it's pain that gets them to turn back to the God. And so in their defeat, they do kind of, they turn back to God. But they know something maybe needs to change. They long for a more centralized, unified people. Maybe that's what they were really seeking more than, you know, but it comes out as we want a king like all of the other nations have. And so they go to Samuel with this request, and Samuel says, okay. And we get Saul, the first king, a king like all the other nations.
Well, that's a warning. He warned you about a king or I think we could extrapolate from just a king, but the idea of a strong central government, at least our founders understood that the dangers of a central government. Do you have that where they're warned about how the king will send them to war?
Right.
He'll take their young people and put them in his employ. He'll take taxation so he and his family and his people can eat. Over and over, he gives a warning.
I believe it's in chapter 8.
Is that where that warning is?
I believe so, yes.
Yes, it warns against a kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
This is how a king will reign over you. The king will draft your sons and assign them to his chariots and charioteers and make them run before his chariot. Some will be generals and captains. Some will force to plow in the fields and harvest its crop. Some will make its weapons. It just goes to, and these are really what we see happens with an increasingly ever-growing central government taking more and more control of the people, less and less of the freedoms. And our founding fathers knew that too, as well from the scriptures, and put checks and balances, as you said, Stacy, to check the growth and the ever-growing power of a central government.
The best kind of authority is an authority that is a relationship. That's why a father is the best authority ever, the children, because he loves them. And the more removed you are from, you know, a king who's very removed from just the day-to-day and the families, if they give them ultimate authority over everything, it's going to be outside of relationship. I think that to me has always been very, it's very human nature. That's very
Well, it's good that we have city government, we have neighborhood groups and city government, county government, state government, and then the federal, the large. But the problem is that the federal just continually expands and eats up pretty soon all the power and all the resources. It's a very good warning for Samuel's time and for ours.
This is a little parenthesis, I guess, here, but on, I guess, different types of government. I took a class, and I can't remember what it was called, but we studied those things and just different governments, and we're not alone. Governments have studied them throughout the ages, and I think it's Aristotle's, I can't remember which book it is, but he writes on the different types of government, and he says that the most ideal, I mean, in theory at least, the best government, the most ideal, is a benevolent king. But we will never have that because no king is benevolent. We need it at least in this, or, you know, but that is kind of what we long for is, and the reason being is because a king, the nice thing about it being a central and one is that it moves very quickly. You get decisions faster. Problems get solved quicker because you've got this ultimate authority that doesn't have to trudge through everything. So, I mean, if you really want just the best, quickest, most efficient form of government, it's a good, all-knowing, powerful, but good king. Which won't exist in this.
That's what we have in King
right,
Jesus.
Right, that's exactly.
King Jesus. Well, I want to mention one thing, and I'll ask it in form of a question. We talked about the ark gets taken, the Philistines don't want it. They decide finally they don't want it because God's judgment falls on them. And so how did they return it? How did the Philistines return the Ark of the Covenant to Israel? Well, the hitch up, what made the way they returned the Ark so special and unusual and even supernatural?
Okay.
They hook it up to a cow, and the cow pulled the Ark in the cart by itself. The cows walked and delivered the Ark to Israel. So my question is, what was so unusual about this, that the cows walked and carried the Ark back to Israel? If you know the answer and can give me an answer to that, go to soapy@thebiblelie.com as an email address and give me the answer.
Okay.
What was so unusual and even supernatural about the cows delivering the Ark back to Israel?
Okay. That sounds like there's a story enough. Is it not just that cows delivered it back?
Yeah.
There's more. Well, wonderful. So this is the Bible Live. A quick note. So we read through the scriptures together at thebiblelive.com or biblelive.com. And then on Sunday evenings, we will discuss the previous week's reading. There are questions, too, for each week's readings that are also on the website. We can ask them somewhat throughout the program, but also you could feel free to go to that to the website and find those questions at any point. You can email soapy@thebiblelive.com. If you have questions yourself, feel free to email those. If you have answers to questions, put it in the email, and we'll see, we're trying this out. We'll see, maybe we have some prizes or some fun things for you for the first person that answers. So, yeah, we'll continue talking about Samuel. We are now to where the people have demanded and requested, really want a king like all of the other nations, and think that that is key to say. They don't want just a king as Deuteronomy describes that they can have. They want a king that is like all the other nations. And so they get Saul. And Saul is from the tribe of Benjamin, who they had almost wiped out only probably about a decade or two before. Had to have been at least 2 decades before.
But he was handsome and he was very tall. Mm-hmm.
And it is though who God did choose for them.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is God gave them what they asked for. And I think that that's kind of, it reminds me of that. There's that part in The Magician's Nephew of C.S. Lewis, the witch says all, or Aslan says of the white witch, or of the witch in that one, all get what they want, not all always like what they get. Yes, God gives them what they wanted, what they asked for, which is kind of a punishment, because what they want is not what God wants for them. But he gives them Saul, and he is tall, he is handsome, he is of the tribe of Benjamin, and
he seems humble. He seems humble in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
When they go to get him, he's going to become the king. He's hiding. He's hiding in the luggage that they brought with them. So there's kind of a brokenness and humility about him that we see here in the beginning. And, of course, we'll see how it develops, and we begin to see weakness in Saul. He doesn't quite get the vision of God for Israel. I don't think he gets it. He understands the rituals. He understands how it works, but he doesn't get the unique calling of God's people to worship him and to share him and to honor him. I think that's the weakness in Saul. Mm-hmm. He gets a form, you know, he gets the rituals, but knowing the heart of God, he doesn't seem to have it.
And maybe this is a good moment, too. You said he kind of seems like there's a humility. And maybe this is a good chance to talk about what really humility is. Because just being reluctant or underconfident or hiding doesn't mean you're humble.
That's very good.
Right. And he had this, because he was reluctant and he was kind of underconfident about stepping into this role, but that doesn't mean he was humble. In fact, it was more of an emphasis on his ability. Can I do this? Am I capable? And which is the opposite of actually what true humility is. But I believe our music is going to come up, so maybe we can talk about that more after the break.
Well, we can. Let me put it this way. In, for example, Saul, we noticed in the beginning, he is an introvert. And we usually think of an extrovert as outgoing and gregarious. Never an introvert is humble and shy, you know.
Right.
But actually, extreme shyness or being an introvert and being an extrovert, they have something very, very much in common. Extreme introvert, extreme extrovert, that both of them have something very much in common. And that's the, we will leave that for our next segment. What do an extrovert and an introvert, an extreme expression of either of those, what do they have in common?
Right. And so that's a good, that's a good note. And sorry, I always feel a little bit bad comparing Saul and David because they, poor things, they probably get compared all the time. But they're put before us and it is there. And I think it's okay. I think it's a worthy study. And it's something that, you know, for all of us, a good lesson, a good takeaway. Like, what is true humility? How can we not be more like David or less like Saul, but just how can we be more like Christ?
Be more like Jesus.
Well, that's our break music. So we will come back after this and talk more about.
Let's be more like King Jesus.
Like King Jesus, yes. Children's voices when they're singing is so sweet.
Yeah. Very appropriate.
Yes.
Children, and we're talking about maybe humility.
Yeah. Well, just
brokenness.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is an interesting thing because
have a juxtaposition.
There you go.
Of extrovert and introvert.
Yes. And I you know, Jesus, you hear, come to him with a childlike faith. And one of the sweet things about children, you hear a lot of times, like, you don't have to teach a child how to sin in terms of sin nature. It is born. And that is true. I mean, we are born with that irrevocable, irresistible tendency towards sin and selfishness. Just look at a two-year-old or a toddler. You know, but there's also, though, a sweet innocence about children when it comes to pride and humility before that has kind of set in. As much as they are sort of me focused, it's not so much an accomplishment me as it is just a survival me. You know, there at least there kind of tends to be. And then as you grow, you know, get older, you start to realize, oh yeah, people are looking at me. There's that the self awareness, like the and that kind of either the confidence and that overconfidence in your abilities and your ways, or what sets in is an underconfidence. Oh, I'm not able.
People are looking at me.
Yes, and but both of those have at the core, at the heart, what has not gone checked or unchecked, or what has gone unchecked, is that intense focus on self.
Extreme self-awareness.
Right.
Is at the heart of both extrovert and introvert.
Mm-hmm.
And I had not myself even realized that until adulthood, that both are fruit of selfishness, being self-obsessed.
Mm-hmm. Especially with how others view you, I think, as you get older, especially, maybe not as a child. And so that's one of the sweet, I think, things of the childlike faith, is it's not about how others view you. You're coming to faith and to trust, just focused on really what your creator, how he views you. And then as you get older, it's there's that confidence aspect. It cannot be in your abilities or what you can or cannot do. It is nothing in so many ways. It has absolutely nothing to do with you. And that in a good way. And let that be a encouragement to you. It is not about you. He is working and moving and bringing about. He is at work on the grand scale. And I think that's... something Saul, I think, could have really used a word of maybe encouragement or of some help. Saul is not about you.
He had a lot of encouragement. God, even in the way he is chosen to be the king, in chapter 10, I think in 9 we meet Samuel.
What do you think the difference is? You know, I mean, he's not the first reluctant king or prophet even. Moses was reluctant. Moses was reluctant and was given Aaron. Mm-hmm. You've got Jonah was reluctant. And who else? You have a lot of, why do you think...
Well, I don't think Jonah was reluctant because of shyness.
Right. The difference.
But what we see, we meet Saul in chapter 9, and he is anointed king in chapter 10 of 1 Samuel.
Mm-hmm.
And after he's anointed, notice that Samuel gives him... the advantage of knowing that God has chosen you.
Right.
It isn't about you. God has chosen you. And he lays out a few signs or miracles that prove to Saul that this is God's will, God for you. He has called you.
Yeah.
And he names out some signs in chapter 10. You're going to go from here, and you're going to meet this person, and you're going to meet this person, and these people, so Samuel had the guarantee, in a sense, God gave him a special sign to overcome his shyness, to believe that you are the one that God has called to be the king.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it would gracious and good and loving of God, if indeed Samuel was underconfident, he gave him every chance to be confident, but not confident in himself. confident in the Lord. Right. And I think it, I don't know how it changed exactly. I don't know when the change was that takes place in Saul's life from that confidence in God and serving God, Godward. You seem to think it might have something to do with his his legacy.
Right.
Maybe
Jonathan.
He wants his children to be the king and the next king. And he becomes very jealous of David because he wants his son to become king. Maybe that's it. I'm not sure.
And then when David comes along, I mean, there's a whole, it just seems to get, no, it is hard. Saul's story is tough. I also, because you see too, throughout, like, not only is he given the assurance that this is, you are the chosen one, God has anointed you, he chose you, but it also in chapter 11, then the Spirit of God came powerfully upon Saul and he became very angry. He took two oxen and, so, I mean, there were moments when Saul very clearly was indwelt, you know, his spirit, God's spirit was upon him.
And he prophesied, he preached at times.
Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of almost, sense of almost, but then there is a clear, there is a clear moment where God says he passes over Saul. So Saul's no longer the anointed. I will choose my servant David. David becomes clearly who God has marked for as the next. And Saul, you get this, knows this. And so here Saul's kind of having to live with the fact that he has been rejected. And that's tough. He, instead of kind of a repentant heart, instead of a humility, he kind of digs in and just turns all of that angst, all of that anger, all of the jealousy then on David. Even when his own son Jonathan is best friends with David.
That is the strangest and one of the most interesting relationships in the scripture is the friendship, the deep friendship between Jonathan and David.
Right, which you would think would be a gift to Saul, you want your children to have good friends, and it's one of the things that I hope for my son that he has good, solid friendships, and yet something so good turns into,
especially as king,
right?
Because you know what normally happened to the king's children, and
right,
when another king takes power, they killed them,
right?
And
right.
That's why they make a pact, a promise between them, Jonathan and David, that he would not be like other kings. I'm now got to keep. It's about power, evidently, and now got to keep the other king's children from growing up and competing for the power of the kingship. And so they kill him quite often, which is what we see.
But Saul had the assurance that this was not going to happen.
No, that's right.
But he still, whenever I think of, again, maybe it's a little parentheses, but just that jealousy that just eats you alive. I don't know if this is what applies, for Saul, but it was Tim Keller who talks about, he had a sermon, he was talking about envy and jealousy and, a lot of things that we can help deal with that and work it. Envy, I thought this was kind of interesting too. Like of all of the, the quote unquote, the deadly sins of all of the, I think it's, what is it? The seven deadly sins. Mm. envy is the only one that you get no pleasure from. Whatsoever. I mean, because some of the things you might satiate, like, oh, your anger, okay, well, it's satiated by just killing or something. You know, sorry, that sounds awful, but there's a little bit of a satiation, gluttony, you know, well, yeah, those first bites of ice cream are great, or anything. There's always something that's sort of enjoyable, but envy, it's horrible. Nobody wants to feel it. You know, you don't want to.
How did you learn that?
Isn't that an interesting thing? I know. I do not know this from experience. No, somebody else observed that, and I thought, oh, that's an interesting thing. Envy is kind of this, you don't want it, and yet you can't seem to shake it. It's not pleasurable. It's awful. It destroys.
Only when something bad happens to the one. Something bad happens to the one you're jealous of, maybe. I don't know.
right, maybe. Or you say, which is a horrible thing, though. You know, I think it's in that sense too, how just awful it makes you feel or look. But anyway, so envy, the power of it, and he ultimately, when we're dealing with envy. And I'll just mention it, I guess, because that is one of the things that marks Saul's story so much is, you know, you think of Saul, you think of, oh, yeah, jealousy, Saul being so jealous of David. But did you know that, and this was kind of the ultimate trump card, if you're frustrated and if you're dealing with envy, he talked a little bit about Amadeus, right? Sometimes you're envious of or you're jealous for something, but sometimes it's not a bad jealousy. In other words, if you are an incredible artist or if you're longing to be able to do or give something to the world and be remembered by the world by something that is good, it's tough when somebody else does it so much better than you, or when you can't quite realize your potential, when you can't quite, you want this and you see other people doing it. And so he talked about, like with Amadeus, it wasn't because he hated music, but it's because he loved music so much. Sorry, about, who is the one that was jealous of Wolf of Amadeus?
The Italian.
Yes.
Yes.
And so he was consumed by this jealousy, not because he hated music, but because he loved it so much and he couldn't be as talented as Amadeus as was. And
that's a very interesting observation. And you actually have to watch the movie Amadeus.
It's a great
to know it about that.
Yes.
But
yes, and so, but he talks about then Lewis, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, great friends. They were actually good friends. They lived at the same time. They were both professors. They both were interested in English literature. And so they had talked and they both decided, okay, we're going to help each other and keep each other accountable in our writing. And we both desire to write books. And so they began this journey of let's put out and write. Well, C.S. Lewis goes on and writes his first book and
what
then his second book.
What a competition.
Right. Well, yes. And Lewis just, you know, he just
Narnia.
Cranks them out.
Mere Christianity.
Yes. Yes. And Tolkien, meanwhile, is still writing chapter one of The Hobbit. You know, he can't. Yeah. And he, Tolkien talks about this or writes about this at some point, and he hit this major writing block, and he had finished writing a chapter or two of the first of the trilogies of Lord of the Rings, and he hit this writing block, and he couldn't write anymore. And some of it was because his friend over here just keeps on cranking out book after book, and they're successful, and he started to just a little bit of jealousy kind of set in.
Yes. I've never known this.
And he said what fixed it was he fell asleep one night, had a dream, woke up the next day, and just went and was able to write again. And the dream was, and he actually published the dream as a short story. It's called Niggle, Leaf, Leaf, like a tree and a leaf by Niggle. Nagel. And this man is commissioned. He's an incredible artist. He's a painter. He's commissioned by the town to draw a mural representing the town. And he's excited. It's the biggest job of his life. He can't wait to do it. He goes and he starts it. It's never quite right. And then he misses the first deadline. And then, okay. He tries and it's just not right. And he, for years and years, and by now the town is so frustrated with him and he's frustrated and he cannot get this mural. He just can't. And he, to the point, and then he dies. He dies. And then he, goes to kind of what is heaven. And he looks up and there is the tree that he had been trying to draw. There it is in all of its glory, spectacular and beautiful and perfect and exactly what he had hoped and imagined that was the tree for his mural. And it was right there. And that is what released Tolkien of the pressure of this timeline, was the reminder that You have the talent, you have it. It might not be realized in this world. It might not, but there is an eternity, there is that heavenly that we're all going to, where your talents and your abilities will ultimately reach their max potential. And I don't know. That was very freeing for me. Just personally, as you kind of, you know, you're going about and, you know, other children or other families or other, you know, in school, other people in their grades, or, and you want so badly, you have such hopes and for this world, and you have such, and, you know, expectations on your life, and just that sweet reminder that this is not the end. This is just a little beginning. There's a whole eternity that is your ultimate destination. And on that.
Saul needed a Stacey Dollar.
He needed a J.R.R. Tolkien.
Give him a shot of confidence. God had to work in you and with you and had a plan for you.
And I hope that for Saul, actually. I often have thought, well, just because Saul sort of failed in this test doesn't mean we don't know. I don't know his heart. Ultimately he did love Jesus and have a real relationship with God and his faith was in the coming Messiah, and maybe he will be there in heaven and he'll be a great king in heaven.
It's funny, I have had that same thought in prayer that, well, Saul, what I think was missing, I've concluded, is he doesn't get the unique calling and purpose of God for Israel, for the nation he was called to lead. Mm-hmm. And he got sidetracked into selfish issues and so on, instead of realizing, like David got sidetracked also by selfish issues, but he repented. He came back to he understood what God wanted to do with Israel, with his people.
Know the character of God. David seemed to, he knew God's character. He knew God.
Because he had sought him so consistently and stubbornly, seeking God. It seems to be different from our friend Saul in that in that case. And his son Mephibosheth received the blessing of David as well. Mm-hmm. David kept its promise to Jonathan and his son Mephibosheth. He didn't wipe out the son or attack him. He took care of Jonathan's children. We see that in 2 Samuel chapter 9. It's where we run into that David keeping his promise, the promise that he made with Jonathan.
Speaking of Well, this is but just kind of back to maybe that idea of pride and humility. Another mark, I think, of David that is neat as far as humility. You know, you would think that somebody dancing in the streets after a victory, I know that, I think that's later, but that's you think of David. What made me think of it was you talking about knowing God's character and then David and just the worshipfulness that David has. He just worships with abandon. In his psalm and in his writing, everything is a metaphor. As the deer panteth for the water, so my soul longeth after you. He's very, he worships well and with abandon. He dances in the streets and you would think that maybe that's a prideful, like, what an idiot or a proud.
It would be for me. I don't dance.
You don't.
I explain it to people all the time. They say, why don't you dance at the wedding or something like that? And I say, no, I don't dance. When I dance, it rains.
Oh, that's right. You've got a good excuse.
My standing joke.
But there's that. You get the sense that he doesn't care who was, you know, he doesn't know, he's not thinking about himself. He is just excited and celebrating the victory that God gave and has that focus on him. I don't know, I think those are some of the, let's see, some of the specifics, though. Do we have any more questions? Or we've got... David, we made it through, we did get to 2 Samuel, but just through the first two chapters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I was going to ask someone, what would Jonathan's son's name, what are you going to do that just to make them say Mephibosheth?
Right.
I remember when I was recording the Bible, I was so tired one night from reading the Bible, I could not say the word Mephibosheth. It just would, and so I had to quit recording because
that's your test. That's your litmus. Yeah. If you can say Mephibosheth, you can keep going. Well, that is our music and the end of this program. We've had so much fun. This is the Bible Live. Next week, we will be reading 2 Samuel, continue that, and discuss it on Sunday. So stay with us. Go to thebiblelive.com to listen, and we will be back next week.
Nothing I desire compares with you.
The Bible Live is dedicated to helping restore the Bible to our culture. Mailing address is P.O. Box 18888. That's Box 18888. San Antonio, Texas, 78218.
Hear the entire Bible every year on The Bible Live, weeknights at 9:30 on this great station. Then join Soapy every Sunday evening at 9 o'clock for fun, inspiration, and valuable prizes on
The Bible Live Quiz Show.
Visit our website, BibleLive.com. That's BibleLive.com for more information about Soapy and The Bible Live broadcast.
You may also order materials at the website and make tax-deductible donations to help minister to our military personnel and broadcast the entire Bible every year to America and the world.